This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 17th of June 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 154, with me, Andrew Tuck, Sophie Grove and Hugo MacDonald.
On the show this week, we're talking to film producer Sandra Schulberg about her very personal relationship with the 20th century's most dramatic court case, the Nuremberg Trials.
And we'll be taking a wander down paths of old with author Robert McFarlane, whose new book traces ancient walkways from the Hebrides to the Himalayas.
All that, plus a selection of great tunes, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
And hello, everyone. Well,
hello.
It's a revolving kind of crew here, isn't it, on the Monocle Weekly these days?
Well,
you never know who's in town.
Well, last week it was just us. Oh, the week before it was just us and we're lonesome.
But now we have Hugo as well.
Hello.
It's a threesome again.
Hi,
gosh.
Everyone.
It's more fun with three.
A family of three. That's a much nicer way of putting it, Sophie Grove.
Am I the child, then?
I'm not sure. I think maybe...
It's quite an odd parent coupling.
You possibly are. Design editor / offspring.
Surrogate
now,
son.
That's the hierarchy.
Beyond these walls, I've never seen so many people in Monocle. Because it's a country fair.
It is.
I know. It's all happening outside, isn't it?
And how do you spell fair, Sophie?
With a Y.
Of course.
No, you say it in your proper voice.
And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Oh, that's very good. Yes.
It's my favourite promotional advert that we've done since Monocle 24 launched, I think.
I have to admit that I didn't actually mean to sound like the Queen when I was doing that. I was just trying to sound enthusiastic.
It's kind of like Buckingham Palace, you know, Tea Party versus Monocle. I don't know which is posher when you're promoting it.
I'm not sure. No, it was, but it is. It's meant to be quaint, but also
there's a dash of Enid Blyton in there too.
There was some irony with the jam. I think it was good. It was very good. But anyway, we've had this is day two of the Monocle Country Fair, and despite the weather, we've had petting zoos, we've had bands, we've had so many kind of well-known people come through the doors and into the radio station. It's been good.
It's been lots
of
fun.
You talk about
fun.
Revolving doors on the Monocle Weekly, but actually, it's been a veritable revolving door all weekend here.
Yes. Now you're off on your journeys this week.
I am. I think so are you, and you. I'm off to Sardinia.
Are you?
To Porto Cervo for a story there about this 1960s resort.
You pick the toughest places to go for your commissions, don't you?
I just pick the stuff off the beaten track design hotspots.
So you're kind of packing like a sailor's outfit and things.
Yes, exactly. A bit of sunshine. Where are you off to, Andrew?
I'm going nowhere. I'm here. I'm here all week, actually. Yeah.
Someone's got to be here, really, frankly. Everyone else is practically taxing the runway. I'm going to Beirut and then directly to Italy and then more or less directly to France. So
working
bye.
Your way back home gently.
Yeah. So you're, it's like but a grand
you're,
tour.
You've got a kind of holiday sandwich, haven't you? Is that correct? There's a bit of holiday in between two work commissions.
No.
Or is Italy work as well?
Yeah, it is. I'm going to, I can't spoil it really, but I'm
going
somewhere
in Italy.
Someone in Italy, Livorno. And
good.
That's all I'm going to say. Otherwise known as Leghorn.
Yes. How did I know that?
Like the chicken. Good.
Foghorn.
Well, I'm very pleased for you, but I'll be here. And I'm really excited that you're going to Beirut, because you're a Beirut virgin.
I am, yes.
And I love it.
I know, I've never had so much advice, actually, because so many people are kind of aficionados here of Beirut, especially the amazing hotels and places to eat. No surprises there. I'm not actually going to have so much time to do that, but it's good to be well prepared.
Yeah, but you must squeeze in a meal or two while you're there.
Yes, a meal or two. So have some meze and a falafel on us.
Good.
Okay, as it were. Anyway, we're going to be back in a minute and we're going to be looking at the world of the Nuremberg trials. Today on the Monocle Weekly, we're joined by a film producer for whom the medium's power to influence opinion was distilled at a young age. Sandra Schulberg is the daughter of Stuart Schulberg, the man responsible for documenting the Nuremberg trials. His film, Nuremberg, Its Lesson for Today, was a key source in the denazification of Germany. This week, the Barbican Centre in the UK is showing a premiere of Stuart Schulberg's film, and joining us to explain why its power is still so relevant today, we have Sandra Schulberg here with us. Sandra, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. And
Thank
I wonder
you
if you
very
could
much.
Just tell us a little bit about the history of this film. Firstly, how it got to be made and where it's been languishing all this time.
Well, it is a fascinating and it has been so far an untold story. The film was originally made on commission for the U.S. Department of War, partly at the behest of the chief American prosecutor, Justice Jackson, although really all of the four prosecuting nations had an interest in seeing a film about the trial made. Because we have to remember that at the time, you know, people didn't have televisions, and the only way that you would have really seen the courtroom scenes and understood what the trial was about was through a movie. The film was completed in 1948 by Stuart Schulberg, who was part of the original OSS film unit that was charged with finding the Nazi films that were shown in the courtroom. So the film actually includes both scenes shot in the courtroom and cutaways to the evidentiary films that were shown in the courtroom and that were used to, in part, to convict the Nazis, convicting them with their own films.
And this film would have been shown in cinemas?
The film was made to be shown in cinemas actually around the world. The prosecutors, including the British prosecutors Hartley Shawcross and David Maxwell Fife, were very concerned that the world get to see what had happened at Nuremberg. But as it turned out, for political reasons, the United States government, the army specifically, which controlled the film, decided that the film was, in a way, impolitic by the time it was finished. And so it ended up only being shown in Germany, and it's only being shown now for the first time to audiences around the world.
And, I mean, it's interesting it was shown in Germany afterwards. What the reaction then at the time, do you know what it was?
Actually, I know quite a bit about it because, fortunately, when we found my father's voluminous files on the making of the film, we also found the first German audience polls. The film was released on the second anniversary of the conclusion of the trial in November 1948 in Stuttgart, and by U.S. military government. It was shown in regular movie theaters, so people were not forced to see it. They bought a ticket as though they were going to see a bit of entertainment. And military government was, of course, dying to know what people thought, but they were also afraid to ask them what they thought because they assumed they would just get rote answers. So what they did, which was really quite clever, is they sent their German-speaking staff out into the street to follow the audience members home on the trams and the buses and just walking down the sidewalks. And then they scurried back to their offices and they transcribed what they'd heard. And the reactions are extraordinary. I mean, they range from, you know, these atrocity images could not possibly have been filmed here. This is a civilized country and this kind of thing could never have happened. To people who said, you know, my God, now we finally know what happened here and everybody has to see this film. Some people said, you know, how on earth could they put the Russians up there to judge us when we know what horrible crimes they've committed? And some people said, you know, the trial's been over for 2 years. For God's sakes, why do they keep pushing this on us? You know, it's time to move on. Enough already. So you had initially a tremendous range of responses. As the film began to play in theaters throughout Germany, the response began to shift slightly, in part pushed, I think, by military government and by the new press, because all of the newspapers had been shut down and then reopened. So the press began to write positively about the film, and later on in the run, they developed more confidence in the film and in the audience, and they began to actually hand out questionnaires. And what they wanted to know was mainly two things. One, do you think the trial was a fair trial, that your leaders had a proper opportunity to defend themselves? And two, do you agree with the verdicts? So those were the initial reactions.
And Sandra, I wanted to ask you about your role in reconstructing the film. What happened to it? And you're talking about the content that's atrocities and footage from the courtroom itself. How did you set about sort of piecing it together for a modern audience?
Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify that we did not change a frame of the original film. What happened, because the U.S. government decided to suppress the film, to ban its release to theaters in America and elsewhere in the world, the original 35mm negative was either lost or destroyed along the way, along with all the underlying soundtracks, the music track, etc. So when I learned about the film, I had known about the film, but I'd never seen it. And when I first saw it, I saw first a German print and then an American print. I began to realize that it had to be properly restored and had to be released, partly because it was such a powerful film still, but secondly, precisely because it had been banned. And I felt that it was, one should overturn the ban some 60 years later. So we had the existing prints. We made a brand new 35mm negative using the best print that exists, which happened to be at the German archive. But then we had, the really hard part was we had to totally reconstruct the soundtrack, because once, of course, the soundtrack is on a print, you can't separate it back out again, so you can't use it to make a new negative, a new release prints. And so we went back to the original sound recordings made at the trial and brought the live sound in the courtroom scenes. Then we had Liev Schreiber, a marvelous American actor, re-record my father's original narration. And then we set about reconstructing the music track, which was very challenging.
And Sandra, did your dad ever talk about his experiences and what it was like to see these men in the dock?
You know, unfortunately, my father died really quite young, when I was in my 20s. And although this film and the work he did, the other denazification films he made, was part of our general growing up and background, I had never had the opportunity, well, let's say I had the opportunity, but I never knew enough about his work or about the film to ask him about it. So this is my greatest regret, really, is that he could see, you know, that I never had a chance to talk to him about it specifically, and that he hasn't had a chance to see the restoration of the film.
And can you tell us about the film? I mean, these scenes are so notoriously sort of, I mean, tense, and some of the confessions and they're kind of a performance in a way. I mean, famously, sort of Albert Speer in the dock. I mean, everyone knows, and the lack of remorse, really. Is there a real drama to the film?
It is, I think, still one of the great courtroom dramas in history. I mean, not only are the scenes that they showed in the courtroom of the Nazi atrocities absolutely harrowing to watch, and the film does contain some of that material, but, you know, people, and some of that material has since been, you know, seen thousands of times. What I think people have almost never seen is the defendants speaking for themselves in the courtroom. And it is. It's absolutely shocking. And shocking in part because they're so lackadaisical in a way. And even the so-called confessions, or I wouldn't say maybe confessions, but acknowledgments of responsibility that you hear in a few cases, or acknowledgments of what happened, come off as rather fatuous to me, as though, as you say, a performance, almost like a performance. Speer's performance was very convincing, however, to the judges. He was the most sophisticated, I think, of the defendants, and he was also the only one who really seemed to be acknowledging the magnitude of what had happened and his role in it. And that, there's no question, if you read about the trial, there's no question that influenced the judges and resulted in part in the fact that he was only sentenced to 20 years in prison, whereas men like Saukl, who worked for him, were sentenced to death and were executed.
And I was just going to ask you, you know, one of the things we had talked about in the introduction was, you know, does this have lessons for today? Do you think it does?
Well, I absolutely do. And it's not just my opinion. I mean, what's been fascinating for me about releasing this film now, some 60 years later, is that the people who work on the front lines of international criminal justice in the world today have really embraced the film because, you know, they say this was a lost document. We never had access to the story of the trial as it was happening. And for everyone you talk to who has worked either with the ad hoc tribunals, starting with the Yugoslav trial, followed by the Rwanda, the Sierra Leone, now we have the special courts, the special chambers in Cambodia. All of the people working in this field, including those who were responsible for creating our first permanent international criminal court in The Hague, trace all of these attempts to hold people accountable to the Nuremberg trial and to the Nuremberg principles that were established at the trial. So it's become very obvious that this subtitle that my father gave to the film was really prescient. The irony, of course, is that he, and we found this also in the papers, that they gave it this subtitle, It's a Lesson for Today, because they were so worried the film was coming out in 1948, 2 years after the end of the trial, that they thought they had to remind people that the story of the trial was still relevant. And here it hangs over us now, you know, some 60 years later.
Hugo.
I just wanted to follow on from Andrew's question at you and say, you know, it has been sort of lying dormant for such a long time, but what is the reaction of people who see it today? Is it, I mean, there has been a passage of time. There's obviously, we're now children, grandchildren of people who sort of witnessed and lived through the Second World War and all the atrocities in Germany. Does that sort of detachment of time sort of numb people's reactions to it, or does it make them even more?
It hasn't numbed people's reactions at all. I think that, first of all, even at the time, because this film was buried, most Americans, let alone people in the rest of the world, had very little sense of what actually happened at the trial. It was really only covered extensively in Germany, and Germans were also somewhat disinterested. They were still at the point of trying to just survive and rebuild the country and struggle with democratization, etc. So the film has come, to my surprise, really, as a total revelation to the American audiences and the American critics, who've been absolutely laudatory in their writing about the film. You realize how little people actually know, not just about the trial, but I also have learned that people really know very little about World War II and what led to the rise of the Nazi Party and how this all came about. So I think there are many, many... I mean, first of all, the film itself is very dramatic, but it has so many... It's such a cautionary tale that people seem to really be hungry for it in a way.
Well, Sandra, it's really been extraordinary to hear your story and your father's story. Can you tell us, for people quickly who want to go and see the film, I know it's going to be showing in London this week at the Barbican Arts Centre, and it premiered at the Berlin Film Festival. How can they find out about where they can see the film and where they can find out more about it?
Well, there's a pretty interesting website with a lot of information about the trial and about the film at www.nurembergfilm.org. On the homepage, we keep track of everywhere the film is showing, and we've just finished 10 different language versions, so the film is going to start to be shown around the world. It was shown in Tehran in the fall, and we've made a special edition in Persian for that audience because people overwhelmed me with requests for copies of the film. And there are Russian, Japanese, Chinese, Italian, French versions all done or on their way to being done, and more to follow.
Well, Sandra, as I say, it was extraordinary for you to come in and tell us this story. Now, it'll be interesting to see the impact the film has as it goes around the world. That was Sandra Schulberg, and that film, Nuremberg, its lesson for today, is how you hear being shown around the world, and I would encourage you to see it. We're going to play a song now. This is Deeper Well by Emmylou Harris. That was Emmylou Harris with Deeper Well, and you're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Now, we're often excited by the prospect of a new plane, train or bike scheme that helps open the world up to us. But it's easy to overlook that one of the best ways to absorb your surroundings is by simply strolling on foot. In his new book, The Old Ways, author Robert McFarlane has taken a step back from the highways to find a path less travelled. He's collected the tales of his epic rambles crossing the UK, Spain, Palestine and beyond into an intriguing, poetic and inspiring work. He's here to tell us a little bit more about it. Robert, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
So you're a big walker then?
Yes. Yeah, I started walking young and I kind of kept going. I mean, I spend a lot of time sitting down and the taxi driver who brought me here was most amused to discover that I was not walking to the studio. But, and he claimed he was going to make contact with the relevant authorities.
But has this been a stiff, I mean, labour of love isn't probably the best description for it, but something that you feel deserves to be written down to sort of raise awareness of paths less travelled? Or yeah. Is it just something that you've done because nobody else has done it?
Well, plenty of people have done it, which is sort of the point. Paths are made by walking, and they're made by many people rather than one person. It's almost impossible to make a path on your own. So I wrote a book about mountains, which is really about sort of untrodden ground, and have gradually over a decade or so worked my way down to the beaten track. And I'm very interested in how landscape archives history, archives memory, which is harder to talk about, and the ghosts and the voices of these old paths that are sometimes audible and sometimes absolutely unretainable.
And on that sort of reference to the mountains book, it's interesting to see that lots of these paths are rather flat. It's a different terrain that you're talking about. Do you think it inspires a completely different sort of tranche of literature or a different type of person even?
Well, I live in Cambridge. I'm a mountain lover who lives in Cambridge, so I get the other kind of altitude
Not
sickness.
Not known for its snow peaks.
No. Although there is a Cambridgeshire Mountain Rescue Service, but I think it's a parodic establishment. So I actually spend a lot of my time now at sea level, as it were. Mountaineering has produced an extraordinary literature, probably of all sports, if it is a sport, or pastimes, if it is a pastime. It's produced one of the greatest literatures. Walking is even older. I mean, walking is our oldest technology of mobility. Walking has left the first landmarks that we have made on the earth. The footprint is our first letter, and the footprint trail is our first sentence. So, you know, walking is older than culture. So I'm just one at the end of a very, very long line of walker writers.
There's a very nice bit in your book, I think, when you're describing the nature of a path quite early on, and you say, paths are the habits of a landscape. They are acts of consensual making. It's hard to create a footpath on your own. It's amazing, as soon as you start reading that, you realise that your ruminations, your thoughts in this book is mixing a little bit of, you know, philosophy and the landscape. Do you think that great thinking happens when we're walking?
It's a very good question. Much of that book was thought while walking, but walking can also destroy thought almost totally. And anyone who's walked long distances, as I say at one point in the book, when I hit 20 miles, my brain stops working. My legs keep moving because they fall into a kind of muscle memory rhythm. But all I can really think about are my sore hips and the blisters that are budding on my heels. But I think a thinking gets done afterwards. You might be able to argue for the supermarket as a great place for thinking. Queuing is a great way of thinking. I happen to think that walking is a great way of thinking. And when I couldn't write this book, I would get up and move. And I would often come back.
And just tell me, as a follow-on from that, the people you meet on a path, you know, when we were kids, my parents used to drag us on walks. Whereas my dad used to drag my mum and the rest of the kids, and, you know, we were screaming behind, determined to sit down at any opportunity. But the people you met on paths, there was something very strange. As soon as you left a village and you were on a path, people said hello.
Yes.
And there was a kind of courtesy that happened. And you realised there was another world that people were ready to embrace as soon as they got onto a path. And I wondered, if you know, is there something, you know, about that what paths do to us, and is there something about the kinds of people you meet on paths?
Yes, well, the best word that I have come across is openness, and that means a kind of, without sounding, wishing to sound too spiritual, that means a kind of openness of encounter with the world, with all that's in it, with its temperatures and its sunlights and its birdsong and its weather, but also with people. And you're absolutely right that when you meet people on paths, you tend to greet each other because you're not separated by glass and steel and motion, and you tend to be walking in less of a hurry. But this book is filled with people, and it's about learning from people. And in every landscape I ended up, I found extraordinary people who still made meaning for themselves as walkers, pilgrims and trespassers and tramps and artists and sculptors and cartographers and archaeologists. So this sense of walking as our oldest technology, but also as a kind of cutting-edge technology, was very interesting to me.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, you talk about that sort of path that's come about from necessity, sort of a route that's been trodden. And then I wonder what point walking turned into a sort of a pastime, a leisure sport, yeah. and whether you touch on that in the book.
Another excellent question. In fact, Chaucer, I think, gives us one of the earliest uses of the idea of the pedestrian as a sort of saunterer, as a leisure taker. But actually, then by the 18th century, pedestrian implies, as it still does in some senses in our vocabulary, implies a sort of weary, effortful work. And in fact, chivalry comes from chevalier, which is from being mounted, from being on horseback. So, and then really from Romanticism onwards, from the 18th century onwards, the idea of the walk as discovery starts to rise again, which is about the same time we start going up mountains.
I mean, we've seen the rise of walking holidays in the last sort of two decades. And is that something that there's sort of your anti in some way, because it's much more of a sort of a mission and controlled and a sort of sense of discovery or a sort of effortlessness that doesn't really sort of isn't captured by that quite so much?
No, I don't disapprove at all of walking holidays. Everyone walks in their own way and discovers their own things. And 16 million people a week walk recreationally in Britain, and they do so for so many reasons. So there's a wonderful Spanish artist called Miguel Ángel Blanco who I walk with, and he says, you know, to walk is to discover treasure in this slightly epigrammatic way, and that, you know, everyone finds their own treasures.
Well, Robert, don't go away, because we want to quiz you more about your wanderings, but we're going to stop for a quick song. This is A Long Walk by Jill Scott. Well, that was A Long Walk by Jill Scott. And we're joined in studio, well, we've had in studio for a little while now, actually, Robert McFarlane, who's here to talk about his book, A Journey on Foot. Robert, a question which is a bit down market, probably. What do you take in your pockets when you go?
A penknife, a phone, oatcakes, apple, sardines and some water. That's just the pockets, though. The rucksack's filled with pillows and...
But sardines are a good snack on the road, are they?
Yeah, well, if you're hiking cooking stuff. I tend to take dry food, as it were, rather than stuff you've got to heat up.
And on the feet? Well-worn in boots?
Yeah, well-worn in boots. Although I walked barefoot where I could, where the going was soft enough on the tidal paths and the moor paths. If you get the timing right on the moor paths, the peat is... And the sphagnum is just like walking on duvets.
Robert, you mentioned before the song that you have a walking partner. And do you talk constantly when you're with somebody, or is the experience of walking with somebody different from walking by yourself?
Well, I love walking by myself, but I increasingly love being with people, and I have many different people walking with me, or I walk with many different people in the course of the book, and I just love walking with people who know their landscapes and know their paths, and for whom there are stories attached to features in the place, and I call them sort of songliners, after this wonderful Bruce Chapman idea taken from Aboriginal Australia, that each landscape feature has a note or a story attached to it, and you can tell them in the right order, and that's a kind of map reading.
And is this about cartography and map reading? Do you always have to know where you're going, or are you a sort of flaneur of the wild?
Well, I do like, I mean, it's very hard to get lost these days. We're all globally positioned and satellite tracked and effectively electronically cuffed. And getting lost is a very edifying experience, but one that is increasingly rare. Forests are very good at it, and they're wonderfully disorienting places because your sight lines get shortened. But I also find that open spaces, I got wonderfully lost in whiteouts on Scottish mountains, where you can barely tell what direction the vertical is, and also out on kind of mist-clad tidal paths off the Essex coast. It's extraordinary space. It's like flying.
I was just going to ask you, obviously there's kind of there's like urban rivals to you, as it were. There's like the kind of the Will Self walkers who kind of, you know, practice their skills, you know, the Ian Sinclairs, yeah, who have kind of built up a kind of a similar collection of books about walking in urban spaces. Mm. Is there a kind of a cutoff? Do you shy away from the edges of cities?
No, I love city walking. In the last book I wrote, The Wild Place, has ended very much on city fringes, edgelands, so forth. I've walked with both Ian and Will, and Will quite recently we went for a long walk up the Suffolk coast, which was kind of a halfway house, jumbled and industrial, and in that sense sort of semi-urban, but also on the right on the edge of England, really, on the easterly fringe.
And were they as good a walker as you? Were you quicker?
Do you mean who got tired?
Yes. No, we're going another 10 miles.
Maybe there was a little bit of that with Will, but he very disarmingly admitted to being extremely tired, just as I was starting to feel extremely tired.
I love the way you're on a more or less one-man mission to sort of give Essex a better name, because it's very beautiful.
Is that a question?
I mean, it's underrated, I think.
It's staggeringly underrated. And it's a very good example of how landscape reputation can devolve into a series of clichés, which then dominate behaviour towards it, cultural attitudes towards it, a kind of snobbery, and blind us to certain places. So the Essex coast is 350 miles long. It's longer than any other British county, any other English county.
Now, when you haven't got your hiking boots on, I see in the notes supplied by your publisher, it says that you're planning a performance to be held in a former nuclear weapons test site off the Suffolk coast.
That is true. I can't tell whether you want me to verify it or
falsify
it. I'll tell you more about it.
What are you going to do?
Well, this is Orford Ness, which is a shingle spit about 12 miles long, which looks like an island but is just joined to the mainland. It's the biggest in Europe. And it was taken over by the Royal Flying Corps and then the MOD, owned through much of the 20th century, and was used really to perfect our physics of death. Our military technology was tested there, radar, and eventually nuclear weaponry, the detonations and so forth were stress tested and temperature tested there. It's now undergoing a policy of what the National Trust, who owns it now, calls controlled ruination. So it's an it's like a mini Pripyat, it's like a mini Chernobyl. It's a kind of abandoned zone with these old, very military industrial buildings, all slowly dilapidating in the salt air. And the National Trust, in its wisdom, has commissioned a jazz opera, improvised jazz opera, responding to the landscape, which is going to be performed in this former armory on the site.
And on that note of landscape as inspiration, I mean, in your book, it's sort of laced with other writers who've been inspired by walking and the landscape and that sort of poetry of the landscape. Mm. Who do you think really stands out in terms of who do you tuck into your pocket when you're setting off?
Well, two people, Edward Thomas, the poet who died in 1917 in the Battle of Arras, and J.A. Baker, who wrote about Essex, wrote a book called The Peregrine, which really transformed the way I see not just Essex and not just England, but all landscape, really.
Well, I was just going to say, I think I'm getting the signal. We're we've been quizzing you a little bit too long. Robert, I wanted to ask you before you go, the book is just coming out here in the UK. Is it available, I presume, everywhere around the world? Is it a UK imprint that you, I presume, you'll find on all those online website thingies that you can get books from?
It's published in the UK by Penguin, but it's out in America in the autumn, and then Holland and Italy and so forth.
So it's going to get translated?
It's getting translated, yeah, into various languages, but America in the autumn with Penguin, yeah.
Well, Robert McFarlane, thank you so much for coming in to see us. And that book, The Old Ways, A Journey on Foot, is, as we said, out now in the UK. We're going to now play you a song by Cecilia Starlin, who was performing live here in Midori House only a few hours ago. And that was Cecilia Starlin, who's also well known as the singer with the band Coop, who's a big Monocle favourite. That's all for this week's episode of the Monocle Weekly. This week's show was produced by Paul Noble, and our research was Tom Hall. We're going to see you off with Diane Birch and Mirror Mirror. But for now, I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Hugo MacDonald.
And I'm Sophie Grove.
Goodbye.